And now Fred will introduce our speaker for this evening.
I am Fred. Our speaker is Marianne. We call her Marianne. I've heard her speak a couple times, and I find her heartwarming, honest, dynamic, lots of recovery. When I asked her to speak, she asked me, well, how long does she speak? And I said, well, depends on how many birthdays, but it's about 40 or 45 minutes. So then she asked me if my introduction can take about 30 minutes. So it's now 7:40. Marianne was born, don't know when or where. Her alcoholic, I don't know who that is either. So, okay, Marianne, why don't you tell your story?
Do I have to speak into both of these? Hi, I'm Marian. And I'm grateful to be here, very grateful to be here. Thank you, Fred, for asking me. And I want to say happy birthday to the people who celebrated tonight. And I want to say welcome to the newcomers. I hope that, you know, even if my share doesn't offer you any hope, the birthdays, you know, that were celebrated tonight, there's so much wisdom in these rooms, and I just hope you keep coming back. Okay, so, and I want to say hi to Kathleen, wherever you are, since you're recording this, I'm hoping she'll hear it. All right, so the ick. That's what I call it, because that's how it feels. I don't like talking about my childhood, growing up in an alcoholic home. And I thought if I just never talked about it, that no one would know. No one would have any idea, and everything would be just fine. Here's the thing, though. I didn't realize that my dad's drinking was a problem. I thought that being one of 13 kids was a problem. So I'm number 11. Not only do I have my, you know, my proper name, but I also had a nickname, and I also had a number. And I pretty much figure that by being born into that family, it was insane from the get-go. And probably in the womb was where I actually had sanity. So I can be restored to that. The ick. My dad was always a drinker. He let me drink when I was 2 years old, because it was cute to see a little toddler make a sour face when she drank beer. And nobody had a problem with any of that. But he got very angry when I tried to pour my own beer and I spilled it. And his rage was another problem. When I was 4 years old, we got a call one day that my oldest brother had been working for my dad at his little company that he had, and he had had an accident. And he lived for 3 months with a soft tissue injury, and he died just before Christmas that year. And when that happened, my dad's drinking it was like on steroids. And I think it was because he wanted to die. He wanted to crawl on the ground with my brother. So he crashed cars and, you know, went through the windshield and 350 stitches in his head. And that wasn't, that he was in the hospital for 3 weeks. I was 5 years old, he came home. And a bunch of guys showed up and they sat down and started drinking and laughing about his stitches. He took off the little cap they put on and would scare the kids. You know, I had two younger sisters, 12 and 13. I was 11, they were 12, 13. And, you know, he thought that was funny. It was a big joke to him. But when he wasn't drinking, nothing was a joke. And his anger is what ruled our home. I was afraid. One time when I was very little, I had a graham cracker, but I wanted a chocolate chip cookie. And I got in trouble for that. It's the simple little things that you don't even know are a problem that become a problem. And my mother, the untreated Al-Anon, she was always very religious. I wouldn't be here if she wasn't. And she used her religion to kind of find relief. Now, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, except she wasn't available to us. She just couldn't pull herself back for the children that were still alive. And that was hard. I felt like I didn't have parents. And by the time I was 8 years old, oh, so you have to know, I hear nature abhors a vacuum, I think that's true. So when my parents were unavailable, the older kids filled in. And let me tell you, kids should not be raising kids. Kids should not be in charge of little kids. Because if you've ever read Lord of the Flies or seen the movie, that's what happens. I've jumped off of a roof of a house to get away from somebody who was angry with me because I didn't get them a towel when they wanted it. It was this kind of, you never knew what was going to get you in trouble, what was going to get you smacked up, you know, the back of your head, or shoved or pushed or called a name. You never knew. And so for me, it's anything. Looking out and seeing all of these eyeballs is one of the most frightening things I could ever imagine. Because in my family, if even one person was looking at you, you were in for it. They were zeroed in on you, and there was going to be trouble. So, all right then. My dad's drinking, getting back to that. By the time I was 12, we were running away from him. All the time. We'd hear him coming, he'd hit the top step, and we would scatter. We'd hit the TV to turn it off because he was going to change it anyway, and we would run. And I remember one day stopping in the middle of the dining room and turning to my sister with tears running down my face, and I just said, "It's got to feel like shit to hear your kids running away from you." And I went back in and I sat down. And I just sat there on the sofa, and he came in and he just walked over the TV, and I think he said something like, "What the hell are you still doing here?" And I didn't say anything. I just sat there, and I realized I'm going to sit in this room with my dad. That was probably one of the very few times I had any compassion for him. So, you know, it's not like I can say that from that point on. I tried to have a better relationship with him. I wanted to talk about the language in my home. My mom, I would say to my mom, "Can I go to my friend's house?" And she'd say, "Go ask your father." So I'd make the 10 mile walk to the living room from the kitchen. And I'd say, "Dad, can I go to my friend's house?" And he'd say, "I don't give a good GD what you do. I don't care." And I'd say, "Okay." And I'd go back to the kitchen and I'd say, "Dad says I can go. He doesn't care." In my family, "I don't care" meant yes. So let me tell you how that translates out into the world. A very nice friend of my sister thought I was a cute little girl. And she said, "I'm going to bring you back a souvenir from my vacation." Now, we didn't get to go on vacations in my family because who the hell is going to take 13 kids anywhere, okay? My dad did buy a bus, but we still didn't all fit in this bus, okay? It was converted into a camper. Anyway, so she was going to bring me a souvenir. And when she described it to me, this place she was going and the cute little souvenirs they make, and "I'm going to bring you one." And my response was, "Oh, I don't care." And the look on her face was, if she was stunned, and she said, "Fine, then I won't." And I did not know what to say to make it better. I had no idea that I had just insulted her, because the language in my home was always insulting. No one ever got praised for anything, but if you did something wrong, let me tell you, you knew it. Okay, you knew it before, you know. Well, before there was even a ripple, you did something wrong, smack. And you know, that ick that I talked about. You know, I was never truly beaten. I was hit just about every day growing up, and I never suffered some of the abuse I hear about. But I shoved, my daily life was so shameful to me when I actually went to school and saw other kids didn't live like this, that I pushed it down. I pushed it down so far and so hard, and I went into such a denial that my life wasn't as good as yours, that when I speak about it, it almost feels like I want to vomit it up, because it was just so, it made me feel less than. It made me feel like my parents had given up. And there were other families in my town that had lost, you know, children, and their parents still treated their children with love. And I saw that, and I wanted that, but I told myself I didn't want that. I'd see a dad walking with his daughter, and I'd say, you know, like, look at that. As if there was something wrong with that. Because to me, I couldn't have that. And so it was that sour grapes thing, because I couldn't admit that I wanted that, too. I couldn't admit that. All right, so I don't know how much more of the ick I can talk about at this point, so let's get to the ouch, what I call the reason that got me here. So I pretty much felt rejected my whole life. My mom once told me that when she was young, her mother had died at 39 pregnant, and her grandmother had died at 39 pregnant, so she thought, it's just the way it goes in my family. So when she was 39 and pregnant, that was me. And she told me later, she said, I thought you were gonna kill me. And I gave her diabetes or something, and she said, I was so mad I couldn't even eat a potato chip, but I didn't wanna die. And I thought, you just told me, anyway, like I was like some, like she thought I was some kind of assassin or something, and I wasn't even born. But the reason she told me was because she said she had not been loving to the older kids in our family, because she had it figured out that she was gonna die at 39, and she didn't want them to miss her the way she had missed her own mother when she died so young. You know, to an untreated Al-Anon, that makes perfect sense. You gotta get ahead of this stuff. You gotta plan for these things. And that's what she was doing. She was trying to protect her children by not showing them any love. She just thought that she would die and they wouldn't miss her. And I just thought that was really sad. One day I saw her, of course, after I was born, the curse was lifted, and I saw her walking down a path with my youngest sister, and she had her arm around her, and I took like this mental snapshot, and I said, now that I know she can do that, I'm gonna get some of that too. So we started like just standing there and saying we wanted to kiss goodbye. Or we, you know, like we just kind of bullied her into like hugging us and kissing us. And she liked it. And so, you know, we just kept doing it. And the older kids in our family would come back and see like how we do it, just like sit with our arm around our mother, and they would be so envious of that because they hadn't gotten it. And I told one of my older sisters what my mom had told me, and she said, thank you. Thank you for telling me that. It didn't heal her. It didn't heal her at all. To her, what she said to me was, now I don't have to feel guilty for not caring about her. And I hadn't told her for that reason. So I never told anybody else for that reason. I wasn't trying to out my mom and, you know, get her in trouble. I thought it would be something my sister would understand. So rejection. Oh, and then, my dad, I just always felt like I was rejected by him. You know, he had 5 boys and 5 girls, and he thought that was perfect. 10 kids was perfect. And when I came along, number 11, he had the poor judgment to say something to one of my sisters about, you know, how that was too many kids. And so, of course, they told me when I was old enough to understand that. And you know, and everything else they can tell you to make you feel like you're not the favorite. We were all vying for a position. I used to jokingly say to my mom, it's okay, you don't have to, you know, don't have to worry, I won't tell anybody else that I'm your favorite. And she'd laugh and, you know, and she wouldn't say anything. So I think that was confirmation I was right. So rejection. I grew up and I married someone whose drinking bothered me. And the reason I think he was so attractive is because I knew my dad didn't like him. And that was perfect. That was just perfect for me. So my dad didn't even meet him until after we were married. That's how dysfunctional that was. I had moved away from my home state, came to California with this person, married him, and then he met my dad. And my dad was actually very nice to him. So his drinking bothered me after a while. It didn't bother me at first, but then it did. I think the night that I almost got killed down on Santa Monica Boulevard because we were driving home from an event and he was drunk. And I didn't think that I could say, hey, hand me the keys. That wasn't in my vocabulary. I had a hard time. I've had a hard time my whole life saying what I actually want to say. It stops like right about mid-throat. And then I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then we just do whatever the plan is that I'm no part of deciding. And driving home down Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood, and road rage occurred. And as the two cars are going back and forth, I look over and see the bus that's coming that's going to T-bone my side of the car. And there's nothing like thinking you're going to die to make you have a voice. And in that moment, I let him know what I thought of his driving, and from that time on, he could not drive after a few drinks. I was gonna take control of that. We ended up having a couple of kids, and I was with him for 17 years. And probably 10 years into it, I should have left, but I couldn't leave. Because I felt like it was my responsibility to stay and take care of everything and everyone. I was either wobbly or prickly in my life. I either felt like I don't know what I'm doing, or damn it, I'm doing it this way. And I would just do it. I would force my way through a situation. So that pretty much was the glue that held my marriage together for as long as it did. And when that ended, well, you know, let me just say a little more about that. I don't know how many years I would drive home from work and get halfway home and just be crying that I was going home to that. When I would get home, I would go look in the recycle bin and see how many beer bottles were on the top. And then I would know how much trouble was going to happen that evening. And I was never disappointed. So that marriage ended for a number of reasons, and still I didn't come to these rooms. I felt all the rejection. He had called me names I won't even bother to tell you. It was very painful, but I still hadn't hit a bottom. It wasn't until I met somebody I thought was really, really wonderful, and it didn't work out. And not to go into details about that, but that rejection of thinking, yeah, I finally found somebody nice, but I wasn't enough for him. And I felt like every rejection in my life mattered at that point. And I was so broken, and I didn't think that I was, you know, what do they say, you know, too broken to be fixed, unloved, unwanted, and alone. That was me. That was me. And I went into a depression, and I could get from my bed to my sofa and just lay there. And I was functioning enough to get to work, but not much else. And I had two kids to take care of. So my daughter just came to me one day, probably after 2 weeks of this, and she just asked me if I was gonna be okay. She was crying, and she just laid on top of me and said, are you going to be okay? And I could feel her despair. And I thought, I have abandoned my kids the way my parents abandoned me. Because they were so sad that they couldn't deal with stuff. They couldn't cope. And I was doing the same thing. So I went and saw a therapist, and she said, well, you need Al-Anon. And I said, okay. And I found a meeting up here, the Touchdown Jesus Church, January 5th, 2009. And when I walked in, I thought, I don't have a friend in the world. All the friends that I had in my marriage pretty much went with him. And the guy that I had been dating, nobody in my small group of, you know, people that I knew even knew about this whole thing. So it wasn't like I had a lot of support, I guess is what I'm trying to tell you. And I walked in and I locked eyes with a woman, and I think she could see like my deer in the headlights face, and she said, are you a newcomer? And I couldn't even speak. I just, you know, shook my head, yeah. And she said, come and sit with me. And I'm going to tell you, welcoming a newcomer is probably the most important thing some of us can do, because I believe that saved my life. And probably for the first time in a long time, I felt like somebody cared that I was in pain. And she wasn't gonna fix it. She didn't say, let me, you know, sit here and I'm gonna tell you what to do. She didn't do that. She just sat next to me. And then she asked me, oh, have you been to any other meetings and so on and so forth, kind of the small talk we do here. And I just, you know, shook my head yes or no or whatever. It was the appropriate answer. She gave me try out this meeting, put a little X by one. And I was open to suggestion, and so I did. And I started going to meetings. Now, I always sat near the door. I hear that's a common thing, so I don't feel like I'm special in that regard. But even to this day, I'm gonna admit to you, I look for reasons to like not come back. Okay? I know we don't give out diplomas here, and we don't, you know, like there's no finish line, and I know that. But I'll say, you know, I need to regroup. I need to, you know, I just need to take some time off from this stuff. But I can tell you, within 2 minutes of walking out of this room tonight, if I go down the 2 freeway and somebody cuts me off, that's all the proof I need that I gotta keep coming back. somebody sent me a, well, they didn't send it to me. That's kind of arrogant. I saw it on the internet. But it said about somebody had a cup of coffee and they got shoved in the coffee, sprayed out. And their part was that the cup had coffee in it. If it had water in it or tea, that's what would have sprayed out. And the metaphor is for what I fill myself with. When life shoves me, what comes out? What comes out is what I have inside. If I have kindness, if I have compassion, if I'm filled with hope, when life shoves me, I go to those things because that's what comes out of me. And if I'm filled with anger and disappointment, frustration, fear, when life shoves me, I'm at my very worst. And I have examples of both ends of the spectrum. And that's why I have to keep coming here, because you guys fill me with that hope. Now, getting to the aha. So I go from the ick to the ouch to the aha, because experience, strength, and hope sometimes really doesn't describe it for me. And it's not that I'm special. It's just that I'm scared, and so I have to kind of make this my own. This is conference-approved literature. It's called One Day at a Time. I highly recommend it. I've had it since I started in this program. And, you know, so every year I read each day. And about 3 years ago, I read March 27th, and I read it for however many years I've had it. But that day, it actually got in. Which is another thing I'd like to say to the newcomers. You know, I hear slogans all the time. Sometimes I hear the same information, but it does not sink in. And the slightest change in how I hear it makes all the difference for me. And the example I'm going to give is, they say, if you want to keep it, you have to give it away. And I hear that, and I'm like, oh, that's a cute little slogan. Yeah, all right, that works. Okay, I get it. And then I heard somebody say that his sponsor told him that he would not find recovery by working the steps. He would find recovery by working the steps with a sponsee. And when I heard that, it sunk in. And it's the same thing as, if you want to keep it, you have to give it away. But it's my perception of the thing that either stops me or lets me go. My willingness, you know, just because I'm here, you know, I got a certain amount of willingness to come in the room, but then I can kind of shut down a little bit. And it depends on how a thing is said. So I'm grateful that I get to hear the slogans over and over and over again, because one day I might just understand let go and let God. I might freaking let go for once in my life and just let God. But it's got to be the right day. It's got to be, you know, the right angle. It's got to come at me from the right angle. All right, so March 27th, I finally got it. And if you don't mind, I'll read it to you. At times, I go to Al-Anon meetings in a captious, critical mood that I'm not even aware of. By an odd coincidence, everybody happens to irritate me. This one talks too much. That one hasn't enough tolerance for others. Another has said or done something I consider unkind. Could it be that my attitude is at fault? Let me go back to the Al-Anon fundamentals. What am I looking for? Help and enlightenment. Will I find it if I am only looking for flaws in others? I must remember that I am here for the sole purpose of improving myself and my way of life. And in every meeting, there is some good to be gained, no matter what is said or done. And then there's a today's reminder, as if that first part wasn't enough. I will guard against looking for flaws in others. I will try to see what is good in them. I go to Al-Anon to learn, and every meeting is precious. I have learned silence from the talkative, tolerance from the intolerant, and kindness from the unkind. I should not be ungrateful to those teachers. So I've read that, and pretty much my whole entire life became apparent to me. I carry that arrogance with me. That's my wall of protection, that I don't need you. I hated my dad so much. When I finally figured out it was his drinking that cost him his company, he went bankrupt, and we had next to nothing for quite a while. His drinking did become a problem. You know, I had always thought, because he wasn't the same religion as my mom, and my mom raised us in her religion, I thought my dad was going to hell because he was a different religion. By the time I was 13, 14 years old, I wished he would die and go to hell. I hated him. I hated the fact that I wasn't getting what I thought I needed. And I hated him for it. And I was ashamed. My dad used to say mean things to us. Every word he said to me, his father had said to him. And my dad actually believed that he was a no good piece of you know what. He believed that. And when my brother died, my dad believed it was his fault. I wished my dad would go to hell. My dad was in hell. My dad was in hell every single day from the time I was 4 years old. And I couldn't see it. I had flashes of it, like when we were running away, and I realized it must make him feel really bad. I had flashes of that, but I couldn't hang on to that because it was more important to me to hang on to my anger. That's what got me through so much. I would lie, I would cheat, I would do what it took for me to get where I was going. And I didn't care about anyone in my family. They all lived back in Michigan. Well, and other places too, but that's where I grew up, Michigan. And here I live in California, I barely go to see them. And it's not because I don't love them, it's because I don't know how to talk to these people. We didn't communicate in a way that was, you know, that was filling me. Anyway, it was very selfish of me to move away, but I'm not moving back, so. That's just how it goes. I'm finding my recovery here. They can move here. I'm happy to have them move here. There's the invitation. So today what I've realized is that, you know, I come here and I get to hear the best things ever. If you keep coming back, you're going to hear some of the best things ever. I got to hear that I got two ears so I can pull my own head out of my ass. And I heard that in this room, and I was like, oh my God, that's so true. Oh, I need to buy that CD, because I need to hear that more. There's so much recovery here. And, you know, and my arrogance likes to protect me. So today I'm grateful. I am so grateful that I got through the stuff that I got through, but I don't have to fight so hard anymore. I don't have to be another asshole out on the freeway. And I get to hand the keys to the planet back to God, because I'm not running this thing like I thought I had to. I hear other people in these rooms talk about growing up in big families, and that's when I really knew I was in the right place. And it's not exclusive to big families, I get that. But I don't have to explain that to some people, what it's like to not have a moment, not one moment to yourself, unless you go in the bathroom and lock the door. And when you only have two bathrooms and your dad's in one, and there's 13 other people that want to use the bathroom, you don't get much time to just sit quietly and just like talk to imaginary animals, you know, and be a kid. Once you're out, even if you're outside, you know, the neighborhood was ours and there was nowhere to hide. Nothing you could do that somebody in my family wasn't gonna know about. So okay, so now that's almost a lie, because my dad did purchase a farm, which was about a mile away from our house. And there's recovery in this, even though it's part of my childhood. Because what I realized today, we had ponies, we had a barn, it was 10 acres, it had trees. And it just occurred to me a short time ago that the reason my dad bought that was because he knew we needed a place to run to get away from him. And that, when I realized that about my dad, he knew, even though he was powerless to stop his drinking and to stop his anger and to, you know, and to heal our family. He couldn't heal himself, so how could he heal the rest of us? He had so much guilt, but I really do believe that when he bought that property, because he'd say, go out to the farm, you know, go out to the farm. It's a mile, why do I want to walk out there? But there were ponies, so why not walk out there? And when we were out there, I mean, there was always other kids, but there wasn't Dad. And I think some of the quiet moments I did have were spent out at that farm, and I can be grateful today that he did that. You know, he bought the bus because he thought we were gonna go on a family vacation. We're all gonna pilot this bus. When you got kids puking everywhere in a bus driving to, you know, grandpa's house. We only went to my grandfather's house one time because my dad hated his dad. But we went to visit them one time, and they only lived about an hour and a half away by bus, by camper bus. So that bus sat parked in our yard, and it became the party bus of the neighborhood. And you know, those are the kind of memories that we can laugh about. My dad bought a parrot. He bought a parrot for us, and that thing would dive bomb you when you walked through the living room. He bought a minor bird. He bought a monkey. And when he was bringing the monkey home from Florida, he was driving up I-75 with the windows down, and the monkey was screeching, and he thought it was having fun. And the monkey got pneumonia. So they wrapped it up in towels and put it on the register. And then it disappeared. And they thought, oh, the monkey's gone out into the wild. and it's getting really cold out. Hope it's going to be okay. But the monkey hadn't gotten out. The monkey had crawled under the piano and died. And when my mom used the dust mop and knocked it out, it came out like one of those barrel of monkeys, all flat with its shape like that. And I was standing there and I was traumatized. See, that's the childhood that I was ashamed of. That's the stuff I didn't want you to know. My dad was trying to be a good guy. My dad was trying so hard to be a good guy. He didn't even believe he was a good guy. But he did all these great things. Tried to. You know, he didn't give up drinking until he had his final DUI. I don't even know how old he was. But the thing that brought him to his knees with the drinking was that they couldn't afford to pay. You know, when they started to crack down on drunk driving, I wish they'd have started cracking down 20 years before, because maybe he would have got sober sooner. But when they made it hurt financially and they had hardly any money left, that's when he stopped drinking. And he just said, no, I'm not going to drink anymore. And he didn't. And his friends would come over and he'd be like, yeah, there's beer in the refrigerator. Go have it. And he just wouldn't drink. And they would drink. But when he decided to stop, he did. So today I can tell you, my dad did the very best that he could. The very best. And it wasn't good enough for me. And that's on me. And at the same time, when I do my very best and it's not good enough for someone else, that's okay. It frees me to not be invested in what my actions, how they help you, or you know, if I don't intend to do a thing, if I'm doing my best, then I get to let go of the results. And you guys taught me that here. You guys taught me that showing up and being of service is the best way to recovery, because I don't have to grab my ears to pull my head out of my ass. I get to show up and ask, how can I be of service? I get to say yes when someone asks me to show up and do a thing. You know, fill in, you know, to be an Amius at a meeting and fill in. I am so blessed to be able to do that. Because otherwise I'd be sitting home pissed off that something isn't going my way. I hope this tape isn't going to be like an NC-17, because I mean, I'm really trying to speak with as little profanity as I can. But it kind of gets going, and then look out. So I haven't dropped an F-bomb yet, and I'm grateful for that. So it's being of service. It is loving other people through their worst moments, not fixing them. And I tell sponsees, if you're getting in touch with your feelings and you're crying, I'm not even going to give you a tissue. Don't look to me for a tissue. And it's not because I don't care. It's because you're in a place, to me, that is sacred. You got in touch with your feelings. And you're feeling them. And you're processing. And me with my little tissue really doesn't help. We can deal with that later. You know, I'll love you with a snotty nose or not. It doesn't matter. You guys teach me that. You teach me a lot. I asked Fred if I could bring a stool tonight. And he was like, well, you know, you kind of got it set up perfectly so they can see you and hear you and la la la. So I really obsessed about this whole setup, and now I wish I'd have brought that stool. Because, you know, I'm standing here, I'm feeling like my varicose veins are getting worse just standing here. You guys have also helped me realize that, you know, I was angry with God, and maybe this is the most important thing I can say tonight. I hated God for a long time. I believed in God. And I believed that God was a SOB waiting for me to screw up so he could send me to hell. Or just to mess with me like everybody in my life had been doing. Just mess with me. I'm just going to mess with you because it's funny to see that vein in your forehead pop out when you're angry. Or, you know, whatever reason my brothers and sisters gave me for teasing the hell out of me for no reason. And I felt that God was pretty much an extension of my family. They were my higher power for a long, long, very long time, and God was just an extension of that. And I come here, And I find out I can fire that God. And that's not my higher power. I don't have to accept that as a higher power. And that I can, have a higher power of my own understanding. And I thought, well, if I'm going to have a higher power, it's got to be something really amazing. Something that loves me no matter what. Doesn't fix everything, but loves me. And that I can love no matter what, too. And now, when I meditate, I actually hear my higher power. I don't just... It's like this weird, I can't describe it. I tried to describe it a short time ago, and it's not even like there's like angels or anything, you know, like in the background making noise. I just can't describe what it is to have words in my head that I know are not my words. And it's that simple. And all of the things that have happened in my life, and you know, I mean, we're not gonna do part two of this next month, so what I told you is what you're gonna get. There's plenty more, believe me. I mean, my mom came from a big family. My dad came from a big family. It's everywhere. Just it's suffice to say, you know, alcoholism is, there's plenty more stories. There's a lot more dead monkeys, you know, in that family. And God told me that just because something is allowed doesn't mean it was condoned. And I don't know how he told me that, I just know that he did. And I accept that my brother died, I accept that my parents were distraught, I accept all of the things that happened in my life, because first of all, I can't change it. But I don't have to be pissed about it either. I have a few sponsees, and one was really upset one day about some things going on. And she said, well, you know, and it had to do with higher power stuff. And she said, well, you know, what do you do when somebody does something that's just so terrible that you can't, you know, process it, or you just can't accept it? And I said, you know, I like to think of it this way. We're all doing the best we can. I hear that in these rooms. But maybe we're all in a big, huge play, playing a part that we're supposed to in this life. And somebody's got to be the villain, and somebody's got to be the good guy, and somebody's got to be the, you know, the heroine, and the, you know, you got to have all these parts to play. And maybe sometimes we each get to play a little bit of each part. But I said, maybe when we're all done in our performance, we get to go backstage, and we get to turn to the person that was the villain and say, you know, when you played that part, I was really convinced. I really thought you were an asshole. That was so good. And that lets me let other people do what they do, how they do it. Because we all get to hang out backstage and say, good show. And that's all it is. It's not my will, it's God's will, what happens here in this life. And it's not for me to judge. And, you know, like March 27th told me, you know, I can leave my arrogance somewhere else. I don't have to carry it with me. Once I'm aware of a thing, once I become self-aware and not self-absorbed, that's when my recovery began. I was willing to show up, but, you know, my arrogance walked in the door right behind me. And I was looking down my nose at people. And congratulating myself that I wasn't verbally commenting. But when I'm looking down my nose at someone, they know it. You know, you don't have to say a word. But that stink eye, you know, words aren't necessary. So I became self-aware, and I realized what my part is. And today I get to fill my cup with kindness and compassion, love, forgiveness. I forgive myself. I forgive my family for not being perfect. I'm not ashamed of my family anymore. I still get to love them from a distance, but that's, you know, that's work in progress. And, you know, and today I can see the blessings. All I could see in the past were the failures, and not even my failures, everyone else's failures, and how you had failed me. And that set me up for failure. I continued that failure. So today I get to see the gifts as they are, when they come, and I stopped wishing away my todays for a better tomorrow. I also heard that here, recovery can begin when you stop wishing for a better past. I was guilty of that. I wanted that reset button when I came here. I wanted all that time back. And in a way, I got it because I can laugh at the things that used to shame me. My past has become a different story for me. It may feel like ick to talk about it, but it's because that's where I don't dwell there anymore. And I certainly don't have the same drama around it. I'm not looking for a posse to hate the people in my past anymore, because there's no recovery in that. Where my recovery is was accepting it and loving and being grateful for this life at all. I think that's my time. So thank you for letting me share.